This is a podcast for anyone curious about leveraging software in their lives, their businesses, or their careers. This is Software Defined Survival. Today on Software Defined Survival.
For whatever reason, that pressing that record button was so difficult. And I walked on the show floor and I am just awestruck. And I'm like, I don't want to do anything else.
Are you mentally stable?
No, I'm not.
Greetings, everyone in AV land. My name is Patrick Murray, and welcome to Software Defined Survival, where we interview the people and companies in AV IT that use software to reinvent themselves and the way they do business. We listen to their stories and ask for tactics and advice on how to survive and even thrive in this software-defined world. I'm really excited about our first guest on the show. He is arguably the most successful podcaster in AV. And before you run away saying, what the heck does podcasting have to do with software? I kind of see podcasting and blogging as software-defined media, right? The podcasts and the blogs and things like that, they don't care where you are. They don't care how you consume it. They don't care what time it is, like a radio show and things like that. So this is definitely a software-defined solution, and that's why I'm excited to have this guest on. He started his career in radio, then somehow wound up becoming an AV consultant. I'll have to ask him how that happens. And he also worked as a control system programmer and university technology manager before founding AV Nation. AV Nation is a network of AV professionals whose goal it is to provide to further the AV industry through education and knowledge, something that is near and dear to my heart. And their flagship podcast, AV Week, was first recorded in 2011, and it provides a weekly overview of the AV industry. If you're in AV, you should definitely check out AV Week. It's a great way to get a download of what's going on in the industry. Now, over the years, they've launched several other podcasts like Resi Week, EdTech, and my personal favorite, A State of Control. If you're an AV programmer, definitely check out A State of Control. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Tim Albright.
Yeah, that was way too flowery.
Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you, sir.
Is there anything about that introduction that you'd like to correct?
No, you don't need me on this show now. You just kind of did the whole thing. Yeah, I'm good. No.
Nice.
Yeah.
So
how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm excited for this, dude. I'm excited for you. This is awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I got a couple questions lined up here.
Shoot.
But we could also let this meander and go wherever it takes us.
It probably will.
So I know you have kids. I have a couple of kids myself. And yep. One thing you'll never hear a child say is, when I grow up, I want to be an AV. At least I haven't heard that one yet. Right. So there's usually a story behind how people wind up in this industry. So tell us, how did you get started in AV?
Oh, wow. You mentioned my broadcast and my broadcast background, and I was working for a radio station in St. Louis. And my wife and I, Michelle, had our first child. And it was not conducive. Having a child was not conducive to being on morning radio, which is what I was. Just because, you know, you get up at stupid o'clock in the morning and you go to bed at, you know, really early at night, and it just wasn't conducive for that. And so I was starting to look around, and the alma mater, the college that I had gone to school at, was needing what they described as an engineer and somebody to take care of some projector installs once a year. And I was like, oh, I'm somewhat technical. I'm somewhat, you know, I can do that. And I was already teaching radio production for them. And so I was like, sure, I can do this. And so they hired me on. And what started out as being do a couple of projector installs a year turned into, holy cow, we have no money and we have to upgrade all of these rooms and we have to adjust the programming in these rooms and we have to learn how to properly design these rooms. So I quickly found myself taking Infocom classes and taking classes from various manufacturers and getting certified to program from various manufacturers. And so we ended up having our own little small band of designers and installers for our little college. I mean, we had 180 rooms, which is not, it's not small, but it's not the size of, let's say, you know, University of Illinois, which is also in the state of Illinois, for me. But it was significant for us. And so that got me fully involved in AV almost from the get go. I mean, I went to my very first Infocom shortly after starting there, because of the lack of knowledge that I had, and I needed to get ramped up. So that's how I got involved, was, you know, needing to do a career change and, finding myself, you know, in the ceiling trying to put together a 5-wire BNC, and getting a multimeter out to figure out why the heck my yellow looks weird.
Exactly. Switching the black and white ones, right? Horizontal, yep, and vertical.
Cool. Well, and I sucked at making cables too, so I had all kinds of shorts. that's why I set the multimeter, because eventually I got better at it.
So you mentioned your first visit to Infocom. Do you remember what your first impressions were, kind of walking into
Holy
that hall?
Holy crap, are you kidding me? I fell in love. I honestly, it wasn't the work, and it was, I mean, I loved the work. It was good work, and I still control is still my favorite part of AV, and probably always will be. But when I walked on the show floor, and this is back in the mid to late 2000s, so it wasn't the size it is now. I was absolutely flabbergasted. I mean, I had never been to anything like it before in my life. I had never attended CES as a journalist. I'd been to a number of junkets, movie junkets, where they fly you out and you interview people and this, that, and the other, and you go see movies. And those are smaller by a large margin. But I'd never been to NAB. I'd never been to CES. And so this was my first trade show experience. And I walked on the show floor, and I'm just awestruck, and I'm like, I don't want to do anything else. I simply don't want to do anything else. And I remember walking around and talking to folks, and, you know, that was when I got to meet a lot of folks that I still, you know, consider friends today. I mean, it was when I met a buddy of mine. His name is Kevin Iselli, who happens to work for Crestron, but, you know, met him there, and I met a number of other folks that just took me under their wing and said, okay, here's this dumb kid that doesn't know anything. Let's show him a thing or two.
Yeah. There's nothing like having a mentor in those first years to really kind of explain things that, that are now probably totally obvious to you.
And obsolete, just for the record.
Well, yeah. RGBHV. Bye bye.
Yeah, baby.
So, everybody in AV usually has at least one nightmare project under their belt. Mm-hmm. Let's not talk about that.
Okay.
Maybe you could tell me about your most rewarding AV project and what made it special for you.
Oh, wow. See, that one's harder. I can tell you my nightmare story off the top of my head. So this is not one that I specifically did, but I was in charge of. I mentioned the fact that I worked for college, and the largest construction project that we were a part of, the college I worked at was a small community college, and it was bigger than what it should have been. It has delusions of grandeur at time, and it's a good thing, right? I'm not saying that as a negative. I'm saying that they have delusions of grandeur, and a lot of times they meet those, right? So this is a community college who reaches beyond what the normal community college typically does. They wanted to do a research center, right? There's an organization called Scripps, which is Scripps Oceanographical. Is that right? Oceanic. Scripps Oceanic.
There you go.
Research Center. They study the ocean. Well, I live in Illinois. I live in Southwest Illinois, just outside of St. Louis. We live on the Mississippi, the biggest outside of the Amazon, the biggest freshwater, you know, the longest waterway in North America. There's nothing like that. Right. There's nothing like, and so they wanted to develop a research center, a community college building a research center for the rivers. And where Alton is, which is the little town I live in, it actually happens to be right at the confluence between the Illinois, Mississippi, and the Missouri rivers. So not only are you on the biggest waterway, the biggest river in North America, you're also at this very unique place between where all these three rivers come together, right? So that's kind of the backstory here. They have this grand idea. They partner with a bunch of people and they're like, we're going to build this, right? It is it's platinum or gold level LEED certified building, right? I think when they started off, they were going for platinum, and I think eventually they got gold. And we were tasked with doing all the AV in this research facility. Now, there had been a couple other projects where they built this four-story, $20 million nursing facility a year or two earlier, and we subbed that out, right? That was, you're talking about 30, 40 rooms, I think, six lecture halls. That was subbed out. We helped with the design, and we assisted with some of the direction, but we did not do that. We did this research facility. And at the end of the day, when we had the grand opening and this, that, and the other, you walk through and everything's working and everything's exactly, you know, what kind of the way you envisioned it as a designer. So it was the first project as a AV person, as an AV professional, as a programmer, as a designer, and as an installer, I could sit back and go, yep, we did that and it freaking rocks.
Nice.
Yep.
It does happen once in a while. Has that ever happened again?
No. Nope. Not like that. I mean, you know, it's
a unicorn.
It is. I mean, we've had a couple others, and we had a couple others while we were there. Like I said, we were the AV group, and we did everything because we had to.
Is that why you had that kind of success with it? Because of the control you had over the project?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it was one of these things where we were actually brought in early enough on. And every AV person in the world will tell you the earlier we can get brought in, the more success we're going to have. And we were able to do things like, you know, have conversations about, you know, the network and have conversations. And this is early on with video over IP and integrating. We used a video conferencing system. It was like the second or third video conferencing system the college had ever had. We had two of them in this building because there were visiting scientists from all over the world who had their own waterways that they were concerned with. They would come to this research facility because it was one of a kind, and I believe it still is. It was one of a kind. And so you had folks from China, and you had folks from, I remember Argentina and Venezuela coming here. And so they needed to talk to their compatriots in a secure manner. So we were tasked with creating a secure VTC system and something that was easy for them to use and understand. And you know, this was back way before anybody considered, you know, one button usability. We had a one button system where all they had to do was, you know, come in and we would work in with the scheduling software, and they could hit a button and they were connected to their people if it was the right time and the right schedule. So
very nice. Very nice. Yeah. There's a few things I want to unpack there. Like somebody told me recently when a professor in a university, for example, when they have a hard time with the technology, it kind of takes away from their credentials a bit, right? If they're like supposed to be this really smart person and they're fumbling around with a touch panel, it kind of takes away from the authority that they have. So something like a one touch button, you know, where anybody could really use it, then they could get on with their own job.
So I have a story about that.
All right.
I have over the years worked with a couple of integrators in St. Louis, and I still do work for one group just because I've known them for 20 years and they're good friends. One of the first times I was on a significant college, significant university in St. Louis, and I'm not going to say which one, we were replacing a touch panel. And we get there, and this touch panel is concaved, right? And this is an old, if you're familiar with the old Crestron quick media systems, it was a 17-inch quick media touch panel. So this was not a cheap device to replace. It was somewhere between 15 and 20 grand. And the entire center of it is concaved. And I'm like, what in the world happened to this? And they said, well,
I think I know what happens.
There's this professor who has like 15 doctorates, probably like four or five, but still has a number of doctorates. And it's the first time using the system. And just like any other good programmer, you put in a cool down screen when you're using a projector, especially back then, right?
Sure.
And he said, how dare this thing tell me to wait 2 minutes so I can restart the system? And put his fist through it.
Wow. He actually punched the touch panel.
He wailed on the touch panel to the point where it was busted. Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this, or I hope there are, that have wanted to do that themselves once or twice.
Oh, I'm certain.
I know a guy who threw his laptop across the room once, programmer.
I've done that, dude.
Yeah. I'd always wanted to. You never had the guts to do it. I wanted to, believe me, but never had the guts to actually do it. So the other thing I wanted to talk about that story was, I always like it because a lot of times we do these projects and we go away and we never see how the rooms are used. And usually it's some generic thing that, you know, we never really can appreciate at all. So I like the fact that you actually knew about people using the room and how they're using it, like scientists coming together from all over the world and actually using your technology to collaborate and really produce results. That's something I think we don't get to see often enough.
Well, we, especially folks like you, right? And you know, folks who are either independent programmers, right? You guys are the, you're the mercenaries of the industry. You get called in or subbed out and you don't, all right? You go in and you and I have talked about this before. You're kind of unique because you're in Germany. You get to go around to different parts, different countries, and you've gone to Amsterdam and done jobs. I've done jobs, not a whole lot of outside of St. Louis, but a couple outside of St. Louis. And you're right. You're never, if you are in this position, you're never going to go back to that job, hopefully, as long as everything works correctly, and see how they use it. Now, being a tech manager, if you're a tech manager, yes, you get that ability. You get that opportunity to do it on two different levels. First of all, if you're a tech manager worth their salt, you should at least be there or be available for folks, especially new and incoming faculty, to use your systems. Now, you and I both know that if you have to have instructions on how to use a touch panel, then you've done a poorly job of designing the touch panel. But there are people with 5 doctorates who can't turn on a light switch successfully sometimes.
They've got their minds on other things.
Absolutely they do. Absolutely they do. So we actually developed a number of modules because we were still going from one control system to another control system, even when I left, because we had one standard and we were moving to another. So we had about 3 different types of control systems at our college. So we had different modules. We had recorded them and made them available to new and incoming faculty so they could get used to it, right? If you're in this building, well, this is the type of system we have in this building and this is how you access it. If it's this building and it's just a bunch of, you know, it's a wall plate with a couple buttons, this is how you access it. And so you would still be able to go in and walk through and kind of be available the first couple of weeks of classes to make sure that everything kind of works and kind of comes off without a hitch.
Very nice. Let's shift gears for a minute and talk about AV Nation. Where did the
original... Why? I'm not very serious, Patrick. You should know that by
now. Yeah, I'm getting that. So I'll try to tone it down a little bit.
No, you're fine.
This is my first podcast. Give me a break.
I know.
I'll loosen up.
I have 341 AV weeks, and I'm not even going to count the other ones. So
nice. So where did the original idea come from?
Oh, Lord. So you mentioned very, very, very nicely that my broadcast background. I was weaned and kind of developed as a broadcast journalist at the preeminent news talk station in St. Louis called KMOX. I had a job before I ever left college there. And so I was able to rub shoulders with and learn from some of the best in the business. It was owned by CBS at the time. And so we were trained in the CBS way of how to gather news. And so that is my pedigree when it comes to the broadcast journalist part. And when I got involved in the AV industry and fell in love with it, I kind of put that down for a while. I still taught radio production and audio production. And actually, since 2006, I was teaching students how to podcast. I wasn't doing it myself, but I saw it as an opportunity for up-and-coming broadcasters to, you know, cut their teeth and kind of stretch their legs and stretch their wings and see what's possible in the realm of audio. And in 2005, 2006, I was turned on to This Week in Tech by Leo Laporte. It's the Twit Network.
Yeah,
he has several podcasts. He's probably the most successful podcaster, period. Possibly Adam Carolla has passed him at this point, but from a network standpoint, I would say that Leo is probably up there. So listening to that on a weekly basis, and he does tech in general, right? So he does, you know, cell phones and computers and switches and all kinds of stuff.
Everything.
Everything. Yeah. And he also does it for 2 hours a week, which is way, way more than I can do. So I was looking for something, right? And there were a couple of people who were already doing something. Not what I was looking for, but they were doing something. SCN at the time, and I'm sorry, not SCN, Sound and Communications, was doing a monthly video podcast where they would bring people into a studio and they would talk about a specific project, right? So it was kind of a white paper, a video version of a white paper.
Okay.
Wasn't what I was looking for, but I was looking for the Twit version, the AV version of Twit, right? I want the news and I want it in a succinct way and I want it on a weekly basis. Nobody had it. Right. And I don't know that anybody still does.
Maybe in prints, but certainly not weekly. Right.
But not weekly. Right. And so it's one of these things where necessity breeds invention. I didn't have what I wanted. And so I made it.
Scratch your image.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an old radio guy and I've been in television as well. And I think that that medium has a lot to offer people. You get to learn people's voices. And I don't mean that in the literal sense. I mean, folks understand that I am as much a lover of this industry as I am not overly serious about it. In other words, I don't take ourselves too seriously. I've made the comment both on the air and off the air to our team and to other people. If the projector doesn't work, no one is going to die. Right. You know, it's not life and death. And you have to understand kind of where your place is in the world. We make experiences, and I'm going to totally steal a Vix's line here. We make great experiences. And our job as AV Nation is kind of what we've developed into and what we've realized and me still learning how to be a businessman because I'm a producer. That is my pedigree is we speak directly to the integrators on a weekly basis. Right. Way back when I was in radio, we had, you know, what we called an avatar. Well, this is the person that we're talking to. Well, my avatar for AV Nation and my avatar specifically for AV Week are the folks, the integrators who are driving into their office on Monday morning. Okay. What is it that they need to know for that week to be successful? Right. And that question has driven darn near everything that we've done. It's driven the deep dive into the other, what I'll call niche podcasts that we do on a monthly basis. And that includes The State of Control, which is control and automation. That includes AV Social, which is social media and marketing, which is kind of developed into more marketing than social media because folks need to understand how to talk to their clients. Right. It drove a show actually from one of our underwriters to look at the IT and AV and how they each influence each other. It drove a show that I developed probably about a year ago with a consulting firm called the AV Profession. And that looks at, you know, ways to make your business better. Has nothing to do with the actual technology of AV. But it is about how to be better at your business. You know, we've done everything from interview consultants who help you with your business to interview business authors on how to get super consumers. I just interviewed a guy who I was turned on to by a buddy of mine that I've developed a relationship with by the name of Ian Altman. Ian's a fantastic salesperson. He's a fantastic sales consultant. He's spoken at AVEC. He's spoken at other places. He spoke with PSNI and Super Summit. Well, Ian turned me on to this other guy by the name of Marcus Sheridan. Marcus Sheridan is probably one of the best experts that I've ever read when it comes to content marketing. He turned a this close bankrupt swimming pool company in the middle of the recession. He turned it around within about a year and a half through content marketing. Wow. And reading his story and reading his take on it is fascinating. And it's incredibly important to people in the AV industry. The title of his book is They Ask, You Answer. It's very simple.
Okay.
Your clients are going to ask you questions, probably to the salespeople. When they ask you questions, you answer it. And not only, obviously, you know, Patrick is my client. He's going to shoot me an email and say, hey, what about this? What's the deal with HDMI 2.1? How is this going to affect us? Okay, well, first of all, answer the question to the client directly, right? You know, this is going to how it's going to do it, and this is what it's doing. But then you send it to your marketing people and say, hey, we have a question. Because an old rule of thumb in broadcasting is that between 5 and 10% of your audience will ever, ever contact you, ever. Whether it's a contact, I don't care if you're giving them like $1 million. Well, between 5 and 10% of your audience will ever call in, will ever email you, will ever contact you. Same is true in the business world. Between 5 and 10% of your clients will ever ask you a question that is meaningful, you know, how they're going to be affected. You take those nuggets, because I will guarantee you that at least 20 other clients have the exact same question. They're just not going to ask you.
Sure.
Or potential clients may have that same question. They're just not going to ask you.
Right.
But if you have this piece of content over here, right, and they're searching, how will HDMI 2.1 affect me? Boom, you have an article. Boom, you have a video, whatever. So it's stuff like this that has driven our content to say, you know, how can we best help integrators and honestly also tech managers do their job better and be more successful.
Great stuff. I mean, really, there's a lot of stuff to tackle there. How do you know what to write? That's something I always come up against, because of course this idea of putting content out there, that's how people find you. It's basically SEO, which sounds a little fishy if you ask me, but if you are just writing stuff that people want to know about and they do find you, nothing is better than that. And I know what you mean. Like I have my online courses and I ask students all the time, please tell me what's wrong. And they never answer me. It's like pulling teeth, getting any kind of feedback from anybody. So for me and blog posting, it takes a lot of time. It's really time consuming. It's a lot of fun because it really makes you dig deep into a subject and become more knowledgeable about it and really start to look at it from different angles that you might not have considered. But again, that time investment, how do you decide what to write about?
So we've done a couple different things. First of all, we've started taking our shows, and regardless of the show, there's going to be at least two or three different topics on each episode. And we've started pulling and culling information from there. But me personally, my personal blog, it's what I'm interested in, right? It's what's okay. What's hit me within the last week or 2 weeks. And right now, this week, I am formulating and doing some research for a blog about how tariffs are going to impact the industry in North America, and honestly, beyond North America. In the U.S., our current president has put tariffs on steel.
Right.
Well, let's not be silly. A lot of our products are made with steel.
Sure.
You know, what's a rack? Well, a rack is a big, giant piece of steel, big piece of metal. And so I'm trying to do some research right now because that to me is interesting. And that's a question that nobody's asked yet, is how are the policies of not just this president, but every president, impacting our industry? You know, you look at, what is it? Brazil is one of the biggest exporters to us of steel. Guess what? They're also one of the biggest importers. They are one of the biggest importers of U.S. coal to make the steel.
Okay.
So, you know, you're looking at stuff like this going, okay, you know, and at the end of the day, whether it's, you know, Atlas or it's Mid-Atlantic or it's Chief, and I'm just naming three, you've got so many other people that I could name, that use steel every single day. And our listeners are users or clients or customers, of these companies.
Yeah. Yeah.
How are they going to be impacted? Not today, not tomorrow, because they've already got a warehouse full of steel, but in 6 months or in a year. And then how do they decide whether or not to pass that charge along? You know, sure. So the first question is there going to be an increase, right? That's the number one question is, you know, does Atlas and their racks, do they have to increase their price? Does Middle Atlantic have to increase their price? And if the question is yes, and it's almost like programming, right? If yes, then what, right? Then the manufacturer has to make a decision whether or not to pass that charge along. And most of the time they have to. They're a business,
of
right?
Course,
they have to pass along, you know, their cost increases. And then, okay, so your, you know, HB Communications or your CTI out of St. Louis, your rack price just went up 10%. Okay, you've designed a system, you have a spec out. Well, suddenly you're losing 10 points, right? So how do you recoup that cost? And hopefully you haven't done so too far out, right, to where it's going to hurt you that much. But then how do you adjust your prices? And again, they're a business, so they have to adjust
Absolutely.
Their prices.
Yeah.
And so it just trickles on down to, you know, the final customer, whether it's an education or a Fortune 500 corporation. They've got to, you know, explain the situation. Say, look, you know, our metal prices increased down the line, you know.
It could, I'm putting my programmer hat on, you know, use less hardware. It could cause people to... Right?
That's actually a good
adjust
really good point.
Their yeah. system design, put less stuff in the rack, right? That big matrix switch can be compressed down to a network switch, and maybe the numbers would work out that way. Could be an interesting angle for to solve that kind of
also
issue.
Also, push
there.
People to more video over IP and not
have
a
ginormous
switch.
Exactly.
Well, also, from a programming, from a control standpoint, too, you know, move more towards software as opposed to, you know, a two rack high. Processor moved to software to where
right.
somewhere in the cloud, somewhere in the network.
Oh, how about that? All due to the price of steel.
Yep.
Crazy the way things are all kind of connected to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the business podcast.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's another great subject because there really is no how-to, right? And in AV for a long time, everybody's always been busy. But with things changing, I kind of wonder if in a few years from now, the flow of projects will change just a little bit. If things do become more software based, right? The whole integrators may need to change their business model. There was talk of this years ago as margins started to go down with Amazon. You could buy a display on Amazon, but the model still doesn't seem to be service based. For the most part, at all. It's still this margin-based model of selling hardware.
They're trying.
Yeah. And that's exactly the point that I'm trying to make is like, there's no how to make that jump. And have you bumped into any resources on that podcast to try to just help us, you know, take this thing apart and figure out a new way to put it back together?
Not on that podcast specifically. What I've run into is some folks who are doing it well. And I've run into those folks at different industry events. Two or three of my favorite events have nothing to do with the technology. They all have to do with about the business of AV.
Okay.
And there's absolutely, you know, reasons to go to ISC. There's absolutely reasons to go to Infocom and CEDIA and all the other technology trade shows. Certainly. You get to see cool things. You get to do things, you know, and experience things. But what I would say is that there is more of a reason to go to these business-centric shows as well, these business-centric meetings.
Do you have any examples?
There's the three that I have is PS&I's Super Summit, which that's only for PS&I folks, NSCA's BLC, which stands for Business Leadership Conference, and then AVIX's AVEC, which is the AV Executive Conference. There's not technology. Okay. I mean, there's not a technology showcase there. These are folks that are you're going to have a chance to talk with your peers, in other words, other business owners,
right?
And find out what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong and how they can help you and honestly, how you can help them. And in doing so, you know, you're going to be able to see what's worked and what's doesn't. Now, obviously that there are regional differences and there are cultural differences, not only across, you know, international borders, but also honestly in the U.S., there's regional cultural differences as big as we are. But the basics are the same, right? And understanding that. And it was actually at the BLC 3 years ago now, I ran into a young man who was in charge of an integration firm up in Maine, which is, it seems a little bit out of the way, but they were doing service and support as or AV as a service and support through their clients, right? They had taken the SaaS model, the software as a service model, and converted that into AV rather successfully. And they did it through a number of different ways. Number one was the monitoring and maintaining of their systems. But that conversation and coupled with a couple of different conversations with some other integrators who had moved to AV as a service through not only monitoring, but also leasing the equipment.
The equipment, okay.
So it's not, you know, you, Patrick, as the client, you don't own anything, right? My contract with you says you're going to have the latest, greatest stuff within 5 years. Every year. So it's my job to make sure that the system is up and running and maintained and that you have the latest, greatest, and you don't have to worry about, you know, end of life for a projector or a display or a control processor. Your stuff is just going to work. And it's my job to figure that out. Now, you're going to pay me for that, right? You're going to pay me for that because suddenly you don't have a need for a support team, you know, have a need for, you know, having somebody physically on site, because I'm going to come within, you know, depending obviously on the contract, but within an hour, 5 hours, 24 hours, depending on what the contract says, I'm going to support you to this degree.
Right. Do those numbers work out?
It does for some people. It does for some organizations, right? For some clients, they get it. Right.
Is it really just an understanding thing, or because you could put this in black and white over the next 10 years, system A will cost you X and doing the as a service option will cost also X.
X plus some. Understand that it's not the cheapest option.
But right? You're not laying out the money up front, right?
You're not laying the money up front. You're eliminating and you hate to talk about, you know, people eliminating jobs, but you're eliminating a job or two. So your cost off that. Number three, you don't have to deal with the half-life of certain products, of equipment. And then you don't have to mess with what do you do with that product, that equipment, once it's been taken out. And that is actually one of the dirty little secrets of AV, especially from a technology manager standpoint.
Sure.
What the heck do you do with this crap once you've taken it out of the rack?
It's useless. Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I mean, I had the office I had at Lewis and Clark, which is the college I worked at, it was our head end for master control for our internal TV station. Okay. So I had, you know, five racks worth of equipment, this, that, and the other. And by the time I left there, I had replaced everything in that rack. When I got there, it was all old CRTs and all old analog equipment.
Big stuff too.
Oh my gosh. I had replaced everything in that rack to where it was down to two racks. Okay. I had a back room full of gear.
Yeah. Try eBaying it.
eBaying is worthless, right? Because you get $5 or $10. But then, so we ended up doing electronic recycling. Our college had a green initiative and this, that, and the other. And once a year we did electronic recycling. And that's where a lot of those old five wire switchers went, right?
Right.
To a company that we knew that our college had vetted. They knew what they did with the equipment once they got it, and they were responsible about the way that they disposed of it.
Right.
But, you know, that's one of those things that folks don't really think about, because, you know, I don't care if it's a VCR, if it's a dot cam from 100 years ago. This stuff has, first of all, it has hazardous material in it, right? And people don't think about that, but you've got lead in there. You've got, you know, like this, you know, electronics have got crap in it that probably shouldn't go into the ground. How do you responsibly dispose of that? And some companies absolutely do a really good job of that. They'll have a program to where they'll either give a credit to their clients, or they'll say, hey, I'll take this off your hands, and because we know how to properly dispose of it. Absolutely, there is that. there's also, I would say, a large majority of folks who simply don't know what to do with, you know, a 16 by 16 VGA switcher once they've taken it out and replaced it with a digital equivalent.
Right. So that's like another bonus of the as a service model, right? They would take care of that, that final task. So, and so it sounds like this, this whole as a service model is more about convenience. It'll cost a little more, but you get a ton of convenience. It's like kind of like what Rich Fregoso always says, a white glove service.
Yep.
So what's the holdup?
Getting the AV salespeople to wrap their head around it.
So we're our own worst enemy, kind
Absolutely. Just like every industry, by the way.
Yeah, okay, sure. But this is like a real opportunity to grow because you know, with an as a service model, you know how much is coming in every month for the next 5 years. These are contracts.
Yep.
As opposed to the way we do things now, a project comes in, you get it done, and then you basically start from zero again.
I think some of it is also cultural, and I hate going back to that, but it's cultural as well because you have a business that has a business plan, and it is in their business plan to sell X amount, and they're hiring these salespeople to sell a system.
Okay.
Not sell a contract. And some of that's, you know, some of that's also a cultural shift internally to say, okay, we're going to make this shift. Now, I will tell you that the folks that I know that have gone to the service model and are starting to migrate to it are incredibly successful.
Yeah.
I'm certain that there are failures out there. I have not heard of them, but I'm certain that there are failures out there of people who, for whatever reason, whether it's their market or their client base or whatever, just couldn't get it off the ground. And they've gone back to doing, you know, sales and service as a separate item.
Okay. So to shift to an as a service model is obviously a big investment, right? It completely changes everything.
Yep.
Is there a path to do it incrementally? Maybe.
That actually is how you almost have to do it, right? You can't exactly do en masse. You would have to take it per project, right? So you get an RFP, or you are selling to a client and, you know, you're listening to them and you're hearing their big pain points. But that's the other part is this is not for everybody. There are some folks who will never let you monitor their network. Never let you monitor their system. So unless you can overcome that hurdle, it's not going to be a very successful AV as a service installation. So then you sell them a traditional system.
That could be handled with staffing, no?
Yes and no. I mean, that's a yes. You could put somebody physically on site, right? And then that's another cost, increase in cost. But yeah, absolutely, you could.
Okay, interesting stuff. Let's shift gears back again to you know what that kind of reminds me of? Is like you were saying, to start incrementally. Like I tell programmers, just do something small. You know, find your smallest projects if you want to learn a new programming language and try it on that. Something that you know you could go back to your old language and do in just a few minutes, but just try it on a really small project first. And that's how you gain confidence with these things. That's how you go from crawling to walking.
Well, that's why the most famous phrase in all of programming is hello world.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, seriously, because that right there is, you know, if you can do hello world in a language, then you can go from there.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, definitely. So speaking of control, a state of control. I'm a big fan of it, obviously. And
I am too.
Yeah. It's actually, you know, hearing everybody, professionals that I respect, talk about the different ways to approach AV control. It's kind of inspired me a bit to follow up on some of my own ideas and develop them and even try out a new product or so out on the market. Didn't always work, but do you know of any similar stories on State of Control or any other podcasts where somebody's been inspired to really take action and do something with the information that you guys are providing?
There are a lot actually over the years, and I'm trying to think of the best
pick,
one to
pick your favorite. Up.
I'm trying to think. I will give you probably, I will stick with State of Control. And, oh, good Lord, this has been 2 or 3 years ago now. I can't remember. But Crestron came out with their diamond level programming. And if you're not familiar with Crestron certified programmers, there are, for a number of years, there was, what, 3 different medals. There was bronze, silver, and gold. And then they came out with platinum. And then they came out with diamond. And we did a special episode with the first ever diamond programmers. Now, 2 of them were Crestron employees, but still, there was 4 of them that were first ever. And out of that, my buddy Dave Hatz started talking about doing diamond, and he became a diamond level a year later. The first ever diamond that I ever knew personally, right?
Sure.
I knew the couple of the folks, especially the Crestron folks, but I didn't know them really well. And Dave is the incredible, fantastic, very talented diamond level programmer.
We should also point out that it's about 3 weeks of work to do that certification.
It's, well, more than that, because then you have to, it, you have to keep it. You have to teach every year, right?
Right, so it's a real investment.
It's an incredible investment. And the one thing that I find fascinating is you have to teach outside of your discipline. And what I mean by that is Dave is a network programmer. He could take, you know, network control and run with it all day long. He's a commercial programmer. He has done commercial programming for years. So the first class he did was about home.
It was Resi.
Was nice. residential automation.
Fish out of water.
Right? Fish out of water. And that's what they do to you, right? That's what they do to you to stretch you,
right?
And to get you kind of on the path of making sure that you are not necessarily real, well-rounded, right? Obviously, Hatz probably has, you know, 15 Pro 3s in his house, and, you know, he's fully automated, and, you know, he serves his dog food every morning, you know, kind of a la Doc Brown. But, you know, it's something where it's you're getting outside of your comfort zone and outside of what you do on a daily basis.
So I've had to make this decision myself, and I decided for the time being not to make that huge investment in the next level of Crestron programming, just because, yeah, does it really make a difference? And, you know, from what you're telling me, this guy was inspired to make this huge investment from one of your shows. I don't know. What do you think? Does it really, maybe it's a country thing here in Germany. Maybe they just don't look at certifications the same way. They all kind of look the same and blur, but is there, yeah,
this is why it depends. You're an independent programmer,
right?
I have been outside of the spec part of the AV industry for probably too long. So understand that when I say what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. I have not yet run into a situation where somebody has put on a spec that they want a diamond level programmer. It doesn't mean that it's not out there, right?
Right.
I'm just saying that I have not personally run into or heard about an RFP where somebody has put down that they want a diamond level. I'm certain that there is at least one or two out there that they've asked for. And the other side of that, is there very few situations where it would be warranted?
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah.
Yeah. By and large, most programmers I know, Crestron, AMX, Extron, all of them, most of them that are worth their salt and that get their certification can handle a vast majority of what's thrown at them. Yes, there are whole building automations where, you know, you got to know what you're doing.
Right.
And for that, I would say a higher level certification would be needed and should be called out on a spec. But if that's not what your business is, and that's what not what you're doing on a daily basis, that's kind of a personal question then, you know?
Sure, sure. Got to be decided on case-by-case basis.
Yep.
All right, shifting back to AV Nation.
Sure.
I remember running into you a few years ago, and you quietly whispered to me in my ear that you were going to go 100% all in with AV Nation. Yep. Do you remember that time?
I do.
So what was the biggest reason? What was the biggest thing that gave you the confidence to make that jump?
Two things. First of all, the support of my wife. because any shift like that, you have to have the support of your partner, regardless of who that is.
Absolutely.
Secondly, it was a weird combination. So we had just started monetizing AV Nation, when I say just, I mean this was the first start. We had just started taking on money from other people. Up until that point, it was completely financed by me. I was financing it by doing some odd side jobs, and we had just completed our first trip to ISC, which was an incredibly successful Kickstarter for us. It was very humbling because up until that point, Infocom was a trip that all of us went to anyway. So we were kind of able to kind of cobble together and I could cover whatever nobody else could. But ISC was different. ISC was a big chunk of money. It was 10 grand, which was our budget to go to that show. And our listeners came through and our supporters came through in a huge, huge way. And it was incredibly humbling, but also proved something that we could do it and we could do it differently than other people. And that's kind of what our thing is we cover the industry in a unique way because we're all in the industry. And so I wanted to finance it in a different way, to kind of keep with who we are. And so after ISC that year, I was ISC 2015. After that, I was looking around. I'm like, okay, what makes sense to me? And I'm a big fan of NPR and PBS and BBC in the UK and NHR and NRK and just the way their model is, which is pretty much publicly financed, but no undue influence, I guess is the best way to put this.
Okay.
And so the way that we have our contracts with our underwriters structured is there's no editorial influence. That's just kind of the way we wanted to go. And so we were starting to take on some money, not a whole lot, but enough to offset and to where I didn't have to do the side projects anymore. And the company that I worked for was a independent programming house that I was the ops manager for. Mm-hmm. We got sold. we got sold. Okay. And we got sold to a local integration firm in St. Louis, folks that I have a lot of respect for, good friends with. They were one of our biggest clients at the time. And so I'm sitting in this meeting and not really knowing what to expect from them. They were very gracious. They had all these ideas for me. They wanted to do this and this and this. And I'm sitting here in this meeting going, this is a unique place in my life. This is a unique time. And I have an opportunity. I can absolutely take this job. I could take this job and I could work this job for a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. But AV Nation at the time was in a unique spot that it was one of those moments where you either take it full bore and take it out and spin it and take it out for a test drive and see what it's capable of. Or you just keep it in the garage and it's something that you kind of tinker with on the weekends. And in that moment, I just kind of decided, well, this is my time to figure out whether or not this is something real or not, whether or not this is something that people can really honestly sustain or not. And I told them that. And I remember the owner, who has become a very good friend of mine and one of my business mentors, says, well, it sounds like you're quitting before you ever start. And I said, well, I kind of am. And so I left that meeting oddly on cloud nine, right? Not having a job. I was unemployed thoroughly. And it has been the scariest and craziest 2.5 years of my life, and I would not do it differently.
Excellent. I like how you mentioned you had to recognize the opportunity that was happening. Mm-hmm. That it was a special opportunity that came. You had the Kickstarter, you had maybe a few underwriters. So you kind of proven that there was a need for it, that it could become something. Yep. And then the company getting sold was kind of the catalyst to kind of snap you into reality and say, wait a minute, I could either do this or that. And you chose this road. So what was really your biggest concern at the time? What were you worried about?
Paying my bills.
Yeah, obviously.
I mean, so it's interesting when I tell people my story. The one of the more common questions is, so like you have a wife and you have kids, right? I'm like, yeah, sure. I have all that. I have a mortgage I have to pay for. You know, I have.
Are you mentally stable?
No, I'm not. But no, that's the biggest concern every month. You know, and you know, there are months that are better than others. And I have a really good friend. I've known Michael for over 20 years. He has recently, in the last year and a half, he has gone out on his own and he does IT consulting. And he will lean on me, the poor fool, for advice. You know, it's one of the things where I'll tell him, is like, look, you know, there are going to be days and there are going to be months that are horrible, right? Or you are going to question your own sanity and question your own brains. But we've gotten to the point where we are stable and we are solid. And I'm happy with the underwriters that we have. I'm happy with the group that we've got. And so out of that stability, we're stable now. It's taken us 2.5 years to get stable, but we're stable. So what does any good entrepreneur do once they're stable? You try to grow, right? And so we're in the process of doing some things that we're assessing some things and going, okay, you know, what can we do to be not necessarily bigger for bigger's sake, but what can we do better, right? What can we do better? How can we do things even more differently? And how can we reach more people? And how can we do it more efficiently? And how can we make our underwriters' lives easier? And how can we connect with more integrators? And what are we not covering? And what are we not doing? And, you know, we started doing Digital Signage Expo last year, 2017, for the first time. And we're doing it again this year. Because our integrators are telling us that digital signage as a vertical is important to them. So, okay. So you spend 2 days in Vegas. Right. Honestly, Patrick, it's the cheapest show that I do.
Really?
From a cost standpoint. So it is the least expensive show that we cover. And it's, you know, I'm in St. Louis, so I tell people I'm spoiled as far as flights. It takes me, I can get to any place in the country in 3 hours, you know, at the most. And Vegas is among those. And, you know, Southwest being Southwest, you can get a flight pretty cheaply. And, you know, hotels in Vegas are, it depends on where you stay, obviously, but, you know, those are relatively inexpensive unless you go during CES, which I've heard really horror stories about that, but that's a whole nother issue. You know, you grow from a stability standpoint and you stretch and you see what's possible. You know, we're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. We have our own issues and we're still learning how to be a website as opposed to, in addition to being a podcast company. And that comes with its own challenges because it's something that we never had to worry about, you know, was our website traffic because our podcasting traffic is what it is. And so that's come with its own set of challenges and trying to shore that up and learn because as a business owner, I have to make intelligent decisions. So the way that I make decisions is I want to learn everything about it, right? I don't be an expert, but I have to know enough to make an informed decision. So, you know, learning about, you know, things like you mentioned SEO and learning about things like making sure things are in proper categories and making sure that your permalinks are proper and all this other hoo-ha that I never had to worry about, you know, 5 years ago. So that's a learning, but it's a way that we're able to become better and serve our clients and our listeners better is okay. We're good. You know, we're stable now. Now let's start stretching and growing.
Excellent. Sounds great. Any plans for the future you'd care to share with us?
Take over the world.
Really? Yeah. With a podcast?
Absolutely. Why not? I mean, we're in the, so here's the thing. I see online media as not just the future of media in general, but I see it as kind of where we're going as a society. And I do mean it as a global society. I still believe in print. I think print is a fantastic medium. I think the journalists that work at the New York Times and at SEN are fantastic people, right? I think they do an incredible job of what they do. But I also look at what Time Magazine is doing. Time Magazine, if you've never heard of them, is a little magazine, right? But they start out being a print magazine. If you go to Time's website, you're going to see as much video as you are written content.
Yeah, sure. Right?
Mm-hmm. And you take the flip side of that, a company that started out as being just video, and that's CNN. CNN started out being just video, right? It was the cable news network, for crying out loud. Well, with the onset of the internet, they're as much written as they are video on their website now. So you've got to be, as a media company, you have to be everything, right? You have to provide folks written content as well as video, and I would argue also as well as audio. You have to give your audience what they want in the format that they want it. And regardless of whether you're covering audio visual or you're covering politics, you have to give folks what they want in the way that they want it. And it took us a long time to realize that. It really, really did. Because I fought blogs, right? I fought blogs, I fought press releases, I fought, you know, written content left and right. The folks that helped me run AV Nation will tell you that. But I finally realized that, you know what? Not everybody likes listening to me talk, right? Not everybody likes looking and watching. Some people just simply like to read. Okay, so you kind of go down that road as well. But no, I mean, I am fully ensconced in my business owner's chair. I want to take over the world. I want to be the number one, you know, audiovisual media platform, period. I want to be the number one audiovisual media company out there. I want to be number one. And I say that very humbly, but very honestly. You know, I'm also a competitor as well as a broadcaster. And so how do you do that? Well, you listen to your people. You listen to you. You listen to people who give you feedback. And you make adjustments and you say, okay, did that adjustment work? And if it didn't, well, then you go back to the drawing board and you go, okay, what's next?
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you're doing a great job. You're definitely on the path. You know, I'm a big fan. I remember the first time you called me for a programming job. That's the first time we met.
Yep.
Yeah. And I was like, holy crap. It's too, it's like, I heard your voice on the other side of a phone and not coming through my car speakers. So yeah, there's a lot about the power of, you know, audio and voice and things like mm-hmm. that. But the other modi that you were mentioning, it sounds a lot like the way people learn too. Like some people learn better with text, yep. others with video. And I guess the news is a form of learning too. The next big change could be, right? You're saying that there's this move to video. What happens when everybody has a pair of goggles?
Oh, not everybody's going to have a pair of goggles.
No?
No.
Because then you're there. Like, it doesn't get more real.
Well, and the reason I say that is because I'm a Gen Xer, right? I'm that, you know, that lost generation between the damn boomers and the damn millennials.
Me too.
And yeah, so we are the forgotten generation. And you know, there's, you know, our kids may very well have goggles, but more likely than not, our grandkids or our great grandkids may very well have the goggles. But in the meantime, it is the augmented reality of the cell phone, right? And, you know, it's the reason I say that we probably won't have goggles is this, it goes back to 3D. One of the main reasons that 3D never really took off is because people hated wearing the glasses if they don't have to wear glasses.
Sure.
I'm 43 years old and I don't have to wear glasses, knock on wood, right? So
lucky you.
Exactly. You know, my dad was 40 when he started wearing his readers, and I'm 43 and I still don't have to. So I will fight it tooth and nail, but I'm not fighting it, man. There's a box over there with small print. I can still read it. Now, once I get to that point with wearing glasses, you know, I don't know that I'll feel differently, but I would say that if you don't have to wear glasses, you're probably not really apt to, even if it's going to give you some weird experiences. However,
yeah, okay.
If you are already looking at your cell phone, and let's be very frank about it, we all are,
right?
Then you kind of lean towards that, and there's where some of the AR is going to come from. It already is. Honestly, there's some games out there and there's some programs out there that'll let you, you know, see stuff on your desk if you, you know, if you look at it through your lens, and will give you an augmented reality experience.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting however it plays out.
Yep.
So given your background in the AV press, do you have any ideas on, for somebody, if they're coming out with a new software-based solution, or even if it's hardware-based, something new and a different approach to solving something in AV, do you have any ideas or advice on how to raise awareness for something like that?
So two things. First of all, get yourself a couple integrators to buy into it. Because here's the thing. So regardless of what the press release says, this is the latest, greatest thing in the history of the world, and it will change how everybody does business in AV, period, in a sentence, right?
Yeah.
I just wrote somebody's press release for them. It doesn't matter if you don't have somebody to sell it to, and to give the people in the press a use case, because with very few exceptions, the vast majority of audiovisual press have never been in the back of a rack pulling cable.
Okay.
And as much respect as I have for them, and I have a lot of respect for everybody that I work alongside in the press side of the AV industry, that is one thing that they don't have, is they've never worked for an integrator, right? Sure. So that you're going to tell them it's the latest, greatest thing, and I don't care if it's a display or it's a control program, or it's a switcher. They're going to look at the specs and they're going to compare it to an old, you know, the previous model. And they're going to say, you know, this does X amount more, or this does this, that, and the other. And number one, they kind of have to take your word for it, unless they're physically going to get a hold of it. And yeah, they have the testing equipment to test your hypothesis and your marketing speak. Or they're going to talk to integrators that they trust, that they've developed relationships with. Right. And they all do, you know, they all do their job, right? They have integrators that they trust that they can bring to, that they can bring a product to and say, what do you think about this and why? And then they'll cultivate, you know, use their opinions as part of their coverage, because these are the folks that are using it on a daily and weekly basis. So I would advise you to obviously connect with the press, but also connect yourself with some integrators that you can point the press to and say, look, here is Susie's AV Emporium, who's been using this product for 6 months, and this is what they think.
All right. Great stuff. Thanks for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tim, I think we could go on for a long time here. We're going to have to do a part two sometime.
Okay. Right, whatever. You're in Germany, so you stay up as late as you want.
Exactly. The kids will be knocking on the door here and ruining the podcast any minute. So
it wouldn't be the first time.
Exactly. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely.
Hey, Patrick here. Before this interview, Tim and I had a nice little chat about the very first podcast he ever did, and he gave me some advice about what I should do to just get started. And I'm going to play that for you right after this. But first, I've got a big favor to ask you. If you liked what you heard, if you're curious about how to use software more in your business, your career, your life, if you want to hear more discussions like this, please leave a review on iTunes. Go to iTunes, search for Software Defined Survival, and just leave a review. You know, I try a lot of things. I've written a bunch of mobile apps. I do a lot of online courses at learnavprogramming.com. And the only way for me to know if it's worth it to do these things is from your feedback. I've got a ton of great emails from students at learnavprogramming.com telling me that they love what they learned and they really got something out of it. And that's what motivates me to keep going. And it'll be the same thing with this podcast. Otherwise, I don't know if anybody's listening. So please go to iTunes, leave a review, and that'll motivate me to make more of these and get more great guests on the show. All right, here's that pre-interview with Tim. I hope you like it. Take care.
even with that shift in my head and shift in my philosophy, I sat there for probably 5 minutes yammering and blubbering and just putting off, pressing record before we did our first show. Once I pressed record and I started, it was downhill. But it was the act of physically pressing record and saying what I had been trained to say, which is 3, 2, 1, before I ever start recording. It was that act that I was putting off, right? It was that, for whatever reason, that pressing that record button was so difficult and in the moment. You know, I had Tucker on. I'd never met him before. I had Linda Frembus, who was a longtime AV industry journalist. Her husband works for Fulcrum Audio. And then I had my buddy Michael physically next to me, right? We're sitting in my college radio station that I taught production in at the time. And, you know, I've got things kind of jerry-rigged between two different computers and a recording system and this, that, and the other. But it was until I hit record that it actually started doing anything in my head.
Yeah. Have you heard of the book, The War of Art?
No.
He talks about exactly that. He calls it The Resistance. He gives it a name.
I like
The
it.
Resistance. And he goes into this whole, the whole book is explaining how the resistance is out to get you and prevent you from doing everything you're meant to do. It's a great book.
I like that. The War of Art.
The War of Art. Yeah. It's a good one to read for 10 minutes in the morning to fix your head right.
I like that. Okay.
Thanks for listening to Software Defined Survival. For transcripts and show notes, go to softwaredefinedsurvival.com.